A very good morning, and kia ora, and welcome to Shane Thapo in the Auckland studio.
Tēnā kōrua, namahi kia koutou. Great to be here.
And welcome also to Bridget Morton in the Wellington studios. So kia ora kōrua and welcome.
Morena.
Now, we've got a quite random selection today. It's been one of those weeks where there's not really one thing you can put your finger on, but what is mounting is the questions around this vaccine rollout. And coinciding with now three cases in border workers at the Grand Millennium Hotel. So people are going, okay, one got it, hadn't been vaccinated. How come someone else they're not vaccinated? How come someone else they're not vaccinated? I suppose the immediate question. With the closure of the flights to India as well, how much pressure on the government right now to convince us things are on track? Do you want to kick off, Bridget?
Yeah, I think it comes back to this fundamental question that seems to be asked a lot over the last few months is, how do they not know? So the questions of, you know, people like, well, they were telling us that border workers were all being vaccinated. They told us the border workers were being moved off the front line, that they knew, you know, who was interacting with who. But it appears that they don't have this knowledge. And just, you know, the movement in last week, you know, when this sort of broke, they sort of came out and said they would be removing, you know, non-vaccinated workers off the front line. I see that's developed in the last 24 hours that now
the
they've
end
got
of April.
Yeah. The end of April is 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
Like, really, is that okay? And what that actually really tells me is that they've discovered in a rush over the weekend that actually the number of vaccinated workers is not sufficient to cover the shifts they need covered. Yeah. Therefore, it's actually a much more significant problem than we thought.
Shane, it's reminiscent of, oh yes, the border workers are being tested weekly, and then we found out, and the cabinet, you know, found out that this wasn't the case.
Well, the upside is that we're able to track and trace these people. I think it just shows that those type of kaimahi, those type of workers, not everyone is a full-time employee. You know, it's a heavily casualised industry. Look, I accept that it's not good enough, but I think it's just the reality of that type of industry. And we've taken other provisions to ensure that we are as safe as possible.
Now that we're opening up to this bubble, though, and people put real pressure on. I'm interested in your view on this, Shane. Really strong messaging coming out of the Cook Islands saying, actually, I mean, it's something like 90% of that country's economy is tourism.
Yeah.
And we're seeing some now using the word patronising with New Zealand's response. But we can't, in good faith, open up that bubble and have gaps at the border.
Yeah, well, look, can I just say this, that I'm doing my part and I'm very excited. I'm off to Australia in a couple of weeks' time. I visited the Cook Islands many times. You know, they are our taina, our tūkana, depends who you listen to. But I think what we need to understand about Rarotonga is this is a very tiny country. They have something like 12,000 people who live there. Their medical infrastructure is, which is about the size of Tokoroa, their medical infrastructure, because I've been to their hospital with a sick kid, is very small. So, yeah, perhaps it is paternalistic, but for very good reasons. And if something did go wrong, of course, it would be hauled upon Aotearoa to fix it.
It's getting smaller too, because so many are coming here for work, Shane. But this comes back to, is there a lack of trust in that knowledge of the border system being as good as it should be? And can I ask you, what is your view and government can, at a stroke of a pen, require this, the knowledge being passed on to the employer and or to the health system about who is vaccinated and who is not? Because as I understand it, that is voluntary. And is that not good enough?
Probably not good enough. But, you know, what you want to do is you want to get public buy-in. You want to get buy-in. And sometimes if you overreach from the state, people who might genuinely want to buy into the process might hold back a bit. So I think it's just simply about getting that balance right. It's not an easy task to do that, but I think that's just the reality.
The vaccine rollout was always going to be complicated. Bridget, anyone who thinks it's not is, well, you know, tell them they're dreaming. They're looking at ramping up to 40 or 50,000 doses a day, the goal being by, I think it was, quote, around late May, June. Now, we know they're trying to put together a new computer booking system. We know it's having some issues. We learned that from our interviews on Friday. As soon as you start ramping up the numbers, it was under pressure. Can they get this right? And is there a tolerance of things that might go wrong as they start to ramp up these numbers? Does there need to be?
Well, it seems like it's gone wrong already. The sort of tolerance of when things start to go wrong, it looks like it has already gone wrong. I think the vaccination of border workers is a sign that obviously the systems there are not working. So when you try and scale that up to the next, you know, cohort, and once you get out to that wider population, it's going to be harder and harder. And as, you know, Shane's rightly pointing out, the people that are sort of in those most vulnerable categories and you know, are workers generally, you know, probably most likely to be more likely migrant workers, more likely to be people with lower literacy and numeracy, maybe in communities that are harder to access, all of that kind of stuff. So we need to make sure that it's not just the mandatory systems that are in place, but actually those other systems are in place to support that. And we saw a real downfall in the Valentine's Day outbreak. I remember having the discussion in the studio, you know, when that happened, and sort of looking at it and going, well, actually, who were they communicating with in the actual communities, in the South Auckland communities?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
None of that seems to be addressed. So I can see, you know, the issues around the IT systems. That actually looks like it's, you know, easier to solve. At least you can write code on that. What seems to not be in place is actually that infrastructure around community buy-in. And that's the most concerning part, because the hardest thing to do is access people that are vaccine hesitant.
And I understand that vaccine hesitancy numbers in term are actually declining. And, you know, I work and I live and I operate and I whanaungatanga to the type of people that you're talking about, Bridget. We've seen the Associate Minister, Pene Henare, visit Marae. We've got a great little rollout system at at Papakura Marae. We're doing it at Whare Wātea. So I think those structures are in place. What does concern me is that there is the lack of centralisation and putting the onus of responsibility on 21 quite fundamentally different district health boards.
We know they're already using their own computer systems again, Shane. And again, this was a matter early in the outbreak when we were trying to track and trace. We didn't have one national system that talked to everyone in the country. And we know now as they try and build this, you know, booking system, this vaccination system, we're reading that again the district health boards are off using their own computers.
Yep.
No one says it's easy, Shane, but you know, what is the level of tolerance going to be of this complex logistical delivery of this vaccine if the system's not up to it?
Exactly, and I get that. But you know, there are some positives in this, and also I think what we've got to do is we've got to ensure that we ramp it up slowly and surely, because we only get one shot at getting this absolutely right. And you know, last week, people were saying how great Australia was and their rollout system, and they've got some sort of massive issues. It seems that we've done the right thing by backing Pfizer rather than AstraZeneca. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There are some good things that are happening there. And the other thing is what we've got to do is we've got to ensure that we don't go gangbusters. We get the delivery of the new vaccines in. The last thing we would want is our vaccine centres and the vaccine workers to lay idle.
That's a very good point. But Bridget, again, you've got to keep feet to the fire. So often during this outbreak,
absolutely,
it seems to have been things are reactive. Oh, they're not testing every week at the border. Maybe we should make sure they do now, you know. It always seems to have been, even this recent decision over the flights from India, you know, you've had epidemiologists calling for that kind of tougher admission for a long time. And can they afford to be reactive now we're at this pivotal next stage?
Yeah, and I think that India situation, you know, they called for it really out of the blue. It seemed really arbitrary and they said it was a last resort. Nowhere have they really said where they have tried to target this issue beforehand. It was very clear. The experts were saying, you could see in the numbers coming, that this was a hotspot that we needed to keep an eye on and it was causing some issues for us. But there doesn't seem to have anything to be happening, and they haven't told us anything has happened until they put this ban in place.
Well, but the spike is reasonably recent. Yes, we saw a trend, but the spike, you know, 87 cases, if I stand to be corrected, in 1 month, 17 in one flight. We seem to have a pre-testing position, but of course what's happening is that it's very complex. People don't just turn up on the airport at Mumbai or in Delhi. You know, they often travel 2 or 3 days beforehand after the test. Look, I accept that it is not as good as it should be, that we ought to do better, but these things are just not linear.
All right. We're going to come back later and talk about the health system more generally, and there might be some themes that we pick up on then. And let's accept people are under stress. This is an extraordinary situation. People are working very hard. However, with what's at stake, the opposition has the right for feet to the fire, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is clearly showing that when they put those feet to the fire, the results happen, because often the policies, you know, asked for by National, poo-pooed by the government, come into place a couple of weeks later.
All right, let's have a look at something of the Auckland stresses for the government at the moment as well. First Light Rail, is this you know, a curse to become a Minister of Transport and inherit this. And we do seem to be going back to the beginning. Bridget, you're Wellington-based, I know, but, you know, when you look at the history of this, will it make or break Michael Wood's career?
Well, I mean, for him, he's going to have to do all the work and get none of the credit if this goes anywhere. And it does to me, you know, being Wellington-based, it looks like it's another transmission gully. It looks like a grand plan that's going to supposedly solve this congestion issue, but it's going to take successive governments, it's going to cost much, much more than what we anticipate it costing and take much longer. I don't normally quote Winston Peters, but he was the one that really pushed and went, this looks chaotic, this is going to cost way too much and be too time delayed. And that was his opposition to what was happening last term. That, I think, is still the case now. You've got a working group.
Back to the drawing board. Yeah, on a four-year-old project.
Yeah, yeah, and one that was meant to be of top priority for this government. Yeah.
Shane, the latest I was reading were questions over whether it would even talk to the Central Rail Link. In other words, one is set up for heavy rail, one is talking about light rail. What's your take on where the whole thing's at?
Well, where the whole thing is at, we have to start at the beginning, and the reality is this was stuffed up royally, particularly by Twyford at the time. He had a twin process, you know, setting up the Superfund against NZTA. It just seems to me that Michael Wood has brought a little bit more sensibility to the situation. He's a relatively sort of level-headed guy, and I think he had to bring it back from the start and regather it all, because what we do know, whether it's light rail, heavy rail or whatever, what we do know is that a success of a transport network is integration, and someone who uses our roads every day, uses our public transport, to be honest, less so, we need an integrated approach. And whether we start 4 years ago or today, we just got to do it.
Let's talk also about business confidence being down, of course, according to the latest Auckland Chamber report as well. And this is not surprising. There are many challenges to Auckland at the moment, not the least what's happened in Queen Street and to the central city for various reasons, pandemic and other reasons as well. But how big a risk is this, Shane, for any government when the economic confidence begins to turn, that can become a self-fulfilling cycle?
That's right, but we had a bad set of results in terms of confidence last month, December, January. We were actually pretty good, so I think these things will fluctuate, and I think particularly after the last lockdown, things were down a little bit. The reality is we are in the middle of a pandemic, so you would expect confidence to go up and down, but overall some of our numbers are pretty blinking good. If we look at our comparative analysis, say unemployment between, if we compare that with New Zealand and Australia, the other thing is that I think, you know, if you read the international media and you talk to your networks overseas, New Zealand has been seen as the benchmark in terms of how we can get things right. And I'm really looking forward to the export-led recovery. Of course, the problem with that is that some of our major trading partners aren't at the same place we are in terms of in terms of recovery.
Plus, we're struggling with supply chain issues as well, which often affects what leaves the country. But Auckland, that big economy in Auckland, Bridget, there's no doubt we have done well compared to what had been anticipated when it comes to unemployment statistics, GDP, government's coffers. But then what had been projected was disaster and worst case.
Yes.
Can they continue this narrative that, you know, the economy will respond to the health progress, or are we possibly going to see a stall of some of the sugar hit that hit late last year?
Yeah, I think what has been really clear, and it's across a lot of aspects from COVID, but it's really shown that there is quite often two groups of people that in the response. So people that are exposed to those international markets that have the supply chains issues, those guys are not feeling as confident. Domestic, a lot of people are feeling really confident, you know, particularly that are providing services domestically. But anyone who is exposed to the tourism industry, their confidence is way down. And I had to think, you know, it was interesting, I was looking at these stats over the weekend and just thinking as that news rolled out about, you know, border workers who'd been, you know, who have COVID, there'll be some cafe owners on Queen Street going today, should I, you know, restock this week? Because it looks like we could have an outbreak and I could end up with those freezer full of food again. And that's that kind of concern and those kind of nuance sort of understanding is actually, I think, what we should be taking from these surveys, not going everything's great at the top, because we know that GDP along on itself or all employment figures by themselves don't tell the whole story about what's happening.
Can I just say that? It was a beautiful day in Tamaki Makaurau. I walked the length of Ponsonby Road. I walked the length of Karangapi Road. I walked the length of Queen Street down to the precinct. The restaurants and the cafes were pumping.
All right. Another risk on the horizon with that, Shane, and I'm curious about this. We were talking last week about the construction industries. They see the opening of the Australian bubble, the Trans-Tasman bubble, as a double-edged sword, because it also makes easier for New Zealand workers to go to Australia to work. They know they can come home again if they need to visit family. Post that interview, we had surveys landing from various parties saying, actually, this isn't just construction workers having a look, it's the professions as well. Does New Zealand need to be very careful not to lose people it desperately needs right now?
Of course we do. I'm not blaming this on this this government or the government before, but for the last 20 years, we have invested in a low-wage economy. We've had a whole program for the last 30 years since the introduction of the Employment Contracts Act, goes way back, in terms of skills being lost and easily transferred to Australia. I'll give you an example. Okay, I'll give you a practical example. If you work in New Zealand as a bus driver, you get a little bit above minimum wage, you get a weekend loading, you go to Perth, Australia, time and a half on a Saturday morning, double time on a Saturday afternoon, double time on a Sunday. So, you know, our chickens have come home to roost, and they'll continue to come home to roost if we simply rely on a low-wage economy.
I heard from bus drivers, actually, with some of the feedback we came from. Interesting you should raise that. Again, Bridget, it's a looming risk as borders start to open, and this is where this whole question of where New Zealand is in the queue matters, because there will be a flurry to try and get nurses, medical specialists, certainly heaps in any kind of construction, because Australia's going off as well.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to, you know, vaccination was always put forward as the pathway for us to open up our borders. And therefore means that for people to travel here to get that skill migration that we do need, we can't pretend that we have all the skills onshore that we need, we do need to have that pathway in place. And it sort of goes back to, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg, that you've got to get those vaccinations in place to allow people to come here, but also that means that people are going to travel
wisely. Why we want to be in lockstep with Australia just about every step of the way, actually, including on vaccination rates. Shannon, I know you want to have a go at the ports. Sure. I saw you having a go at the ports on TV the other night.
It's
a shocking report that has come into these fatalities.
It's an absolutely shocking report. But really what got me, unfortunately, motivated in a positive way to a negative situation is when the report, which was damning, when it was received, the CEO said that he didn't know about the depth of the situation. If you talk to anyone who's connected to the ports, this has been going on for a long time. This is the CEO that purposely moved to deregulate and deunionise the port. And the consequence of this, sadly, is two deaths. And if you talk to the kaimahi, you talk to them, because it's not just the deaths, it's the people that have been maimed for the rest of their life. And I reckon two deaths is too many. We've had the public member that passed away. I don't think the CEO has the moral authority or the imperative to fix this, and I think he's got to go.
All right, so you're making that call. On the other side of it, I'm seeing people also criticising the council. And again, this comes back to this model we have with the likes of the the council-owned companies. It's all hands off. It's all, you know, Auckland Transport has this responsibility, or the port has this responsibility. Again, is that a convenient model for politicians?
I don't think it's a good model, to be honest. I think it devolves the primary responsibility, because at the end of the day, it's a ratepayer-funded, ratepayer-sort of oriented organisation. And you know what? If something went wrong with the port and they needed a bailout, guess who they'll come to? They'll come to the ratepayer. So I don't like the model at all.
The flip side of it is, Bridget, you don't want politicians deciding where a road goes, or necessarily the day-to-day operations of a large port. They do have oversight responsibilities.
They do, yeah. I think it's a fine line, but it is, you don't want the Mayor of Auckland making commercial decisions about the port. He's not the best place to do so, and so you don't want that level of interference. But on the other hand, I was quite concerned seeing, you know, Phil Goss' response to it, which is that he intended, you know, that the management would be held accountable by the board and the board would be accountable by the management. It didn't foresee any sort of public pressure or role for him to step out of the top and say, actually, I'm putting the pressure from the top down as your primary owner. to, or representative of your primary owner, to actually get this right.
Yeah, I think it's one of these watch the space folks.
All right, interesting stuff. Yeah. We'll return to another time, actually, the Finance Minister's letter to Air New Zealand, because I find that quite interesting, whereas this era of completely hands-off with some of these models might be beginning to be rethought. We'll pick that up another week, because we've got to carry on. I want to talk about the health system. We know, because we're working on various stories, it is creaking in every direction. We've seen the mental health stuff dominated this past week with the release after a year of a mental health report that some would describe officials seem to want to censor. We are also knowing and hearing about wait times on electives. We're hearing about shocking wait times on even acute cancer treatments. We know why it's under pressure, Shane. It has been for decades. But is it about to explode on this government as the immediate focus on COVID eventually eases?
Yes. The simple answer to that is yes. The simple answer is that if you defer treatment, you know, you might have only deferred the program like 1 or 2 months ago. It takes weeks, if not months, perhaps a year or so to come right. And it's about that bulge about to erupt, and I think it could well do that. I think a little bit too late in terms of the report that was initiated last year. You know, one of the problems we've got is we've got 21 DHBs right throughout Aotearoa, and there just is a lack of coordination, a lack of centralisation, and what disturbs me is that there is not equity of access and not equity of care. The reality, if you have cancer in Wairoa, or if you have cancer in Tamaki Makaurau, you're going to get two levels of care.
Is another restructuring, right at the time the system is under pressure for all sorts of reasons, is it the time to do it, Bridget?
Well, I do agree, Shane, that I think that it's too late almost to do it, but you've got to do it. What you've got to do, though, is make sure it doesn't distract from actually delivery on the ground. And I was really interested to see that even, you know, looking at sort of the stats of last year, you see National Spokesperson for Mental Health, Matt Doocy, exposed over the weekend, huge underspends in mental health.
Yes,
huge. Yep.
The money's been caught up, because it's not just about money. This is the point.
But actual delivery of it. And, you know, it was during a time where I felt for the last year that we had a spotlight on mental health, that we had a spotlight particularly on young people with mental ill health. And here was the health department sitting there not spending money that they could spend and get services to actual people.
Go ahead, Shane.
Well, services, you've got to have staff.
That's the thing. You're missing your psychologists. You're missing...
Exactly, and successive governments have de-skilled New Zealand in critical roles. You know, not just psychologists. They're super important, but you also got to have community care workers. You've also got to have community integration workers.
And we haven't got that. This question to you, though, is after 4 years, why Labor, the Labor government has been in for that long, why we are so slow at implementing any of these things? Because they're at the point now, and I know they've had a pandemic for the last year, but they're at the point now where you can't keep saying, oh, this was a pent-up pressure for all these years, because these are their own programs that aren't being implemented.
That's right. But the reality is that the hugeness of the job has had a negative effect in terms of implementation. And, you know, we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of skill gaps right throughout New Zealand, and again from the very top to the very bottom in terms of the professions, and it ain't going to be an easy fix.
Bridget, the other thing is this also a reflection of the fact that when that government came in, end of 2017, we had one review after another review after one working group after another working group, and guess what? Then they all reported with massive programs. And all of a sudden there's an expectation, there's a focus on the fact you've been in government for 4 years, but you've only got this far.
Yeah, and one of the things, and just returning to those numbers as an example, so they come from the 2019 budget. To put a budget bid up, you have to demonstrate that you can actually, well, I would say, under the previous government, in my experience, you had to demonstrate that you could actually had the workforce and the ability to implement that program. Now, perhaps they did that, but we know that there's these massive skill shortages. So why were they developing and putting money into a program if it couldn't be delivered? That actually tells me that there's something else gone wrong here, not just a workforce shortage.
Well, the other thing is what we've got to do is GDP is very important, but we've got to measure the wellness of our society very on a holistic approach.
Labor scrapped some of those measures, and yeah, I know they were narrow measures. They were cancer and waiting times. But to your point, Shane, this mental health report that was held up for a year, we've seen through Stuff's excellent reporter, the massive scrap that went on in the bureaucracy over releasing honest data. And I've seen Len Cook, highly respected former chief statistician for this country and for the UK, sallying forth on that. Is this another problem we've got? That deep within some of our bureaucracy is this attitude of, you know, don't put the facts out there because they're not pretty.
Look, you can't defend the undefendable. We've had sanitisation, for want of a better word, but probably accurate in reports, not in the health sector, but in terms of the education. And you simply cannot sanitise it. You cannot defend the indefensible. And I think it's that the ombudsman or whoever needs to do some more work in this area, because you know the public do have the right to know warts and all.
Judith Collins is calling for the Public Services Commissioner or Chief Executive Peter Hughes to do an investigation specifically into this. But, you know, I was just listening this morning to the former PM Science Advisor, Peter Gluckman, as well, saying he'd tried to warn three Prime Ministers over the risks of a pandemic like we're run right now. I mean, this is the result of what feels like 15 to 20 years of reorienting the public service away from honest advice, brutal advice, to managing stuff in a way that protects governments. And are we now seeing these consequences landing one after the other?
Yeah, well, the tradition we've always had of that free and frank advice going up to the politicians. The politicians, their job, it's in their interest to manage how that is communicated out to the public. So if the public service has got a duty to release information, which they absolutely
release it.
And I say that duty, it's not the duty to release it, but it's their duty not to withhold it. The Official Information Act was a line in the sand for us that we said all information belongs to the public unless there is a reason, a justification under the Act in which you can withhold it. It demonstrates that there is a view, this example demonstrates that there is a view within some of the public service that somehow the information belongs to them. It does not.
Shane, you might have a comment on this. This is also to do with the growth of the professional media political appointments in ministers' offices who have a different brief. They held far too much sway?
Yeah, I'm very hesitant to beat up on public servants because it's an easy thing to do, but I think, you know, because we've seen through this pandemic that when it counts, our public servants can step up, and they do step up. I think that there is an institutional issue here, and one of the institutional issues is we have too many of our government departments, and this is not a reflection on the people who actually do the work on a day basis, but too many of our government departments that are policy orientated rather than doing orientated. Look, I remember the days where if you work for Māori Affairs, Te Puna Kōkiri, you could get a house, you could get a job, you could get some real advice in terms of starting a business. Today, you'll get a paper.
Well, you haven't even mentioned the comms teams inside these organisations. And again, I don't want to beat up on the public servants, but Bridget, the most frustration I hear from is from public servants who actually want to do things.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. And one of the things that I really saw when I was in government, which was led by the now Public Services Commissioner Peter Hughes, was it turning to get more proactive releases out there. And I know in my job now as a lawyer, dealing with clients interacting with the public service and with government, that proactive releases of information generally cover off what we need and give us what we need without going through all of this, you know, Official Information Act, all of the stuff that actually causes more use of taxpayers' money and resources.
Yeah. And you've got to get the balance right, hey? You've got to get the balance right. You know, we've got the 24-hour, 7-day news cycle. What we don't want is we don't want releases that are released for, you know, sorry about that, but probably accurate. You don't want things that are released before their time and before the due diligence is done.
It's got to come from the politicians themselves.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They have got to tolerate the public knowing and hearing about things that aren't optimal, because actually that is part of a healthy functioning democracy, and I have watched it over the course of my career dissipate, and you're left now wondering how much of this is what is coming home to roost. Final point, you wanted to point out Winston Peters. We haven't heard about his political future. He did a public meeting recently. Did you make of it, Shane?
Oh, well, yeah, just a little bit of context. It was the a provincial growth fund activity in the far north. He was there. He played a very prominent role. And there were the dynamic duo were there, Matua Shane Jones and Winston Peters. Warmly received. Other ministerial, former ministerial colleagues were there, and he outshone them all. I tell you what, I've heard that the hunger is still there. So let's not write off the career
from Winston
of
or from Shane.
Oh, actually, more so from Winston. So let's not write off the political career of Winston Raymond Peters. And I'll tell you what, if you have a look at the numbers, the National Party could do with the possibility of another coalition partner.
I'm not sure what to say on that one, but never say die with Winston Peters, I think. So I think you could be on the money there.
Thanks, both of you. It's much appreciated. Thank you, and Ngā mihi and ka kite anō to Shane Te Pō. Lovely to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
And thanks also, and farewell to Bridget Morton.